The problem with focus groups and with questionnaires and surveys is that people do not always answer them accurately or truthfully. In some cases, they may choose to answer less than truthfully if it's, say, an embarrassing topic or something they don't want to admit to. But often, they simply can't say. They really don't know the underlying reasons.
So what's a marketer to do? Use our intuition? Not so fast. Our topic today is counterintuitive marketing with Roger Dooley, author of Brainfluence. This is episode number 88 of The Big Show. Here we go.
Branding, experience, conversation, promotion, powerful marketing, empowering small business to change their status quo. It's the internet show all about small business marketing. Jay Arrett hosts the brightest minds in marketing. Power to the small business.
So you always hear advice like talk to your customers, take a survey. Guilty. Then there's the alternative, right? Trust your gut. You'll hear that one too. Well, what should you do? Check out option number 3, neuromarketing, which is a relatively new field of marketing research that studies consumers' response to marketing stimuli. It uses technology such as functional magnetic resonance imaging, fMRI, to measure changes in activity of parts of the brain and other things that measure changes in a person's physiological state, hopefully giving us greater insight into why customers make the decisions they do. Because as our guest, Roger Dooley, just told us, they really might not even consciously know why they do what they do. There have been several books written and studies done over the past decade on neuromarketing and behavioral economics, and Roger Dooley has compiled a sort of reference book of all those called Brainfluence, and he's our guest today on Power to the Small Business. First, I want to invite you to take advantage of our free resources on my company website, themarketingspot.com. Click on the free resources spot at the top, and there you will be taken to my library of free webinars, including my most recent editions, Branding 101 and Marketing 101. That's themarketingspot.com, free resources, where we turn entrepreneurs into marketers. Now let's get to our neuro conversation and see if we can tap our counterintuitive marketing selves. Okay, we welcome our special guest to the Skype line. He is Roger Dooley. Roger, tell us who you are. Well, I already said that, who you are, but tell us what you do.
Well, I spend quite a bit of my time thinking and writing about marketing. In addition to my book from Wiley and my consulting clients, I write a couple of blogs, Neuromarketing and Brainy Marketing at Forbes. And really, the pervasive theme through everything I do is trying to use our understanding of how our brains work to do better marketing, advertising, and sales.
This concept of neuromarketing, is it a relatively new thing in the marketing industry? There seem to be more books on behavioral economics and things like that. Is this neuromarketing a fairly new concept?
It's been around probably for at least 10 years. I know that I got my domain, neurosciencemarketing.com, back in 2004 and then started actually blogging there a year later. So that makes the field probably close to 10 years old. It was already being discussed at that time, not a whole lot. And there's different definitions of neuromarketing. Some people prefer a sort of restrictive definition that includes only techniques like brainwave measurements using EEG or brain scans using fMRI to gauge people's reactions to ads or products or whatever. I like a broader definition. To me, I think those are great tools to understand behavior, but there's a lot of other kinds of like behavioral research, both in the economics field and other fields, that really tell us a lot about how consumers and customers behave.
Do you think because of all this advancement and reliance on technology and research and things like that, do you think we are better marketers because of it? Do you think we've learned a lot in, say, the last 10 to 15 years?
I think that we can be better marketers, and in some cases, we're better marketers. There's still a lot of shooting from the hip out there. I just saw a very worrisome statistic just a few days ago that said that half of all CMOs do not place a high value on testing to improve customer experience, which to me is just crazy. I attend a lot of conversion conferences where you talk to people who are professional conversion optimizers. And the one thing that everyone will admit is that it's impossible to predict how customers will behave just from your prior knowledge or best practices. But you simply have to test in each situation to see how your customers respond to whatever you're trying to do. And all these guys at conferences love to delight the audience by putting up a slide. Okay, here's version A, here's version B. Which do you think pulled better? And inevitably, the majority of the audience, who are mostly experts themselves, guess incorrectly. And so the fact that CMOs seem to think that either they or their staff know enough to not bother that much with testing, to me, that shows we've still got a long way to go.
Well, it's very difficult, I would imagine, for the entrepreneur, for the CMO, the marketing directors, to rely on things that are outside their own understanding, I think, because we're fairly egocentric and we think, you know, I rose to this position because of what I know and my gut, right? We always want to trust our gut. But sometimes, I guess the neuromarketing thing is about going against your gut. Would you say that?
Oh, absolutely. There are a lot of counterintuitive things. I think topics like decoy products are one where introducing a product that you don't expect to sell can actually increase sales of other products in the line. For instance, introducing a very high-end product to your line may shift the purchases upwards. In other words, people will buy the next most costly product that was previously your high-end product at a much greater rate, and there's actual market data to show that, because now by introducing that really high-end product, you have said, okay, well, the previous high-end product is now sort of a compromise, middle-of-the-road choice, which is often what people are looking for. And so even if you don't sell any of that high-end product, it can boost sales of your other products.
Isn't that funny, though, Roger? And I find that, you know, I do it too, but people who like to believe that they are above average or want above average things tend to choose the middle of the road. We tend to choose that safety choice.
I think in general, that's the most common choice. You do get a few people who simply have to have the best, and presumably in most cases they have the budget, either personal or business, to afford it. So sometimes a high-end product like that can have some benefits of its own, because there will be some people who purchase it. In general, people are looking for something that is good, not the cheapest thing, which might not work very well, not paying a premium, because I think everybody understands that a Mercedes that costs four times as much as a Chevrolet does not really deliver four times the value. But when they're shopping for other products, they tend to behave the same way. They want something that's going to be a good, solid choice.
Well, you wrote this book called Brainfluence, which is a collection of a lot of these tidbits of information that you just gave me. And I really love the book because it's a handy reference tool. But earlier you talked about counterintuitive, and there's a lot of this stuff that seems counterintuitive. Well, let's start with one of the things I believe that many small business owners and marketers have the most trouble with, and that is choice. And less choice equals more sales, which seems to be counterintuitive, because if you talk to customers, they say, I want more choice. Give me more things to choose.
Perhaps the definitive study on that was one at Columbia University, where they did a study in a retail environment where they're selling different jams or preserves, and some customers had a choice of three, and then other customers had a choice of a dozen or two, where you would think that the fact that you had some more obscure flavors in the larger choice would actually draw additional customers in, the ones who maybe didn't like the strawberry or blueberry or cherry, wow, hey, there's this gooseberry huckleberry jam that would draw in additional customers. But what they found was that the total purchases were lower when the choices were greater, presumably because people simply had difficulty deciding. There was a lot to comprehend. Our brains do not like to work hard. I think one of the great books in the last few years has been Thinking Fast and Slow by Daniel Kahneman, a Nobel Prize winner, which actually the book is very readable despite the fact that the guy is a really deep-thinking academic and a Nobel Prize winner. It's definitely something that anybody can read and get a lot out of. One of the things that he points out is that we have two ways of thinking. We've got the sort of logical, rational, cognitive process where we analyze and compare and so on. And then we've got this sort of simple, intuitive decision-making process. We don't like to use the one that makes us think hard. We will almost always choose the shortcut approach of making a quick emotional decision. And I think that's a part of what's driving the paradox of choice, that I give somebody a lot of choices, and they start doing comparisons and end up just getting all muddled and giving up.
So what is a business owner to do, or even a marketer, when we're presenting choices to the public? How many choices are the right number of choices? Is three the right number?
Well, I think three is a good number, and it's commonly used. And one way to present it might be if you do say, well, gee, I actually need 10 different products because special features that certain elements of the market demand, then you could break it down into several groups, for instance, like choice groups that might make the decision process a little bit easier for customers.
There are certain businesses, Roger, that just have, like, I have 100 different products. There's nothing I can do about it. What are they to do? Are they to just to group them up and guide people through?
Yeah, I think that offering some sort of a decision path where you're not presenting people with 100 choices on one page, but rather get them to the point where there's a good, better, and best, perhaps for logical categories. And not every product really lends itself to that. In certain products, and I think, for instance, apparel or fashion items like watches, in those cases, having a bunch of choices all at once isn't too bad. If I was going to buy a watch, I wouldn't want to see three watches. I'd want to look at, scan through pages of pictures and look at the ones that caught my eye. So, I mean, there are certainly product categories where displaying a lot of diversity is fine and actually is more likely to result in a purchase.
Okay, that's choice. Another one that businesses have a lot of trouble with is this concept of pricing and leading with lower prices. Businesses tend to lead with lower prices to attract customers, believing then that they can move them up to something higher or higher priced item. I call this the elevator pricing strategy. But from what I've read in your book and other places, that research tells us it's not true. Why is that? Why is the elevator pricing strategy not normally a good one?
Well, I wouldn't say it never works. And if you can get somebody in the door, for instance, or clicking through to your website to do some serious shopping with a low price, then that can be a good thing. But the problem is that you're establishing a low anchor value in their mind for that product. If it's a product that you have advertised for $99 and really you'd like to sell them a $299 product, they've got that $99 value in their mind, and it's going to be a big jump for them to move up to the $299 product since they've sort of established the value. There's some fascinating research on products where even an irrelevant number can influence people's perception of product pricing or value. Dan Ariely, the behavior researcher, did a study with keyboards. And keyboards, like computer keyboards, are something that most people don't buy very often. You really don't know what they're worth, particularly one that may have special features. So it's a good product for that. I mean, it wouldn't this kind of test wouldn't work well on a product like a cup of Starbucks coffee, where most people have could estimate within 20 cents of what it costs. But he first asked everybody to write down the last two digits of their social security number and put that on a piece of paper, and then show them a picture of this keyboard and ask them what the value was. And amazingly, the people with low final digits in their number, like between 0 and 20, estimated a value of about $16 or $17 for the keyboard, where the people on the highest end of the range were up in the $80 range. And you could see the progression through each group. So simply introducing that irrelevant number affected the way people saw this product that was just absolutely totally unrelated to that number. So that's the power of anchoring. And particularly if we don't really know the value of a product. If we've been shopping for a product extensively, then the anchoring issue is probably a little bit less important. So in that case, that $99 price might be great if you're planning on selling the $99 product. If I've been shopping and the best price I can find is $120, and then finally I see your ad at $99, then hey, I'm going to click on that and maybe I'll buy it. But trying to move people upwards is more difficult. Now, something that people do for anchoring when they're still discounting a product is to throw out a value number, for instance, a suggested retail price. We're selling it for $99, but this is $109.99 retail price. Or if you look at infomercials, and infomercials are really great sources of advertising and marketing information because they simply have to work. If you see an infomercial more than a few times on TV, you know that that is a profitable sales effort because otherwise they would pull it. They'd lose money on it. So one of the things they often do is throw out high values for their products. They'll add other products in to increase the value of what they offer. You may see something like 1,000 sold at $300, but now, of course, they're offering it to you for $99. And so all of these are an effort to establish that high anchor point that makes the ultimate price that you pay look more attractive.
What's our strategy, though, if, say, we want to sell somebody a $299 item, but we need to draw them in with a lower price, or we feel at least we do?
Well, again, getting back to the testing thing, this is something that I would always say, you know, you can get some advice and ideas from experts and pundits and so on, but at the end of the day, you really need to test and see what works. But I think that if you simply can't get people to your website or your showroom or whatever by advertising the product that you want to sell at the price, I mean, what I would probably consider doing is advertising the higher priced product, but trying to frame that with an even higher anchor. In other words, showing that it's comparable to products that sell for twice as much, or it's suggested retail is 50% higher, or something along those lines to establish a higher value and make the price look more reasonable. If you attract people to the site or the showroom or whatever with a price that's a lot lower, I think that it's going to be difficult to convert them at the higher level.
Well, here we are talking a lot about price and driving decisions that way, but maybe, according to your book, Roger, that the answer is not price at all. Maybe it's emotion, because you cover in your book on selling on emotion. In fact, you cite a study in BrainFluence that says that purely emotional ads are more effective than rational ads only. And in fact, that maybe emotional ads are even more effective than emotional plus rational ads when you combine emotional and reason together. And that seems counterintuitive, right? Because we always want to sell the rational reasons to buy our product.
Right. Well, getting back to Kahneman's work, we don't like to think hard. And when we can make a decision based on emotion, it's easier for us. And often we're even happier with the result when we do things that way. There's other research showing that our subconscious makes a decision seconds before our conscious mind is even aware of that. So where they put people in brain scanners and ask them to make a decision, they could see the point at which the decision was made, and then they asked people to push a button as soon as they've made a decision. And it took an average of 7 seconds for them to become consciously aware of it and push that button. So clearly, a lot is going on below the surface. And in many cases, what you see is the conscious mind rationalizing the emotional decision so that if you bought this a really cool pickup truck with, you know, a big engine and a lot of chrome, the conscious mind will be latching onto things like, gee, this has got 20% better fuel economy than the one I was driving. It's got a great safety rating. It's got airbags. And its hauling capacity is really what I need to get my work done, where, in fact, the decision was made emotionally where I like that truck. It's cool.
We don't want to say that, though, right?
Well, we may not even be aware of it. That's the thing. I mean, we're probably not going to want to admit that, yeah, I just like the truck. You know, I don't really give a damn about the specs. It's cool. Although I still drive a Hummer, and that's basically my rationale. That I just like
it. There's no way around that one, Roger. You just have to say it there, right?
Yeah. And but it's a little one, and it gets pretty good fuel mileage. And I needed to haul stuff.
So how do we tap the right emotion, though, in our advertising and our marketing? Because that's pretty hard, right? I mean, there's lots of different people out there. There are lots of different emotions that people buy on. How do we as marketers and small business owners tap that right emotion?
Trying to choose the right one is very product dependent. Sometimes one way to do that would be through custom, if it's not obvious, like in the case of perfume or cologne. If you have a more complex product, you may want to do some sort of in-depth customer interviews just to try and get in at what they feel about it. And of course, the problem with focus groups and with questionnaires and surveys is that people do not always answer them accurately or truthfully. In some cases, they may choose to answer less than truthfully if it's, say, an embarrassing topic or something they don't want to admit to. But often, they simply can't say. They really don't know the underlying reasons. But sometimes through in-depth interviews in some sort of really deep discussions, sometimes involving metaphors, and you can get at the underlying emotions that drive behavior.
Back to that study about how emotional appeals beat rational, purely rational appeals. But what about the long-term effects on a marketing campaign? Can we get by long-term with just emotional appeals only? There's got to be some long-term effect where we're only appealing to the emotion all the time.
Well, actually, I would say that if you're looking at the real long-term, then emotion is a perhaps the key driver. If you look at the most iconic brands of our time, and Coca-Cola would have to be one, and there's been a number of neuromarketing studies that showed how powerful that brand actually is. Those of us of a certain age may remember the Pepsi Challenge, which was a set of TV commercials years ago where Pepsi would do blind taste tests. And every time they did this, they would show that people preferred the taste of Pepsi to Coke. And that's what drove Coke to develop their new Coke, which was sweeter. And then the whole mess of the revolt against new Coke and so on. But they repeated that challenge in an fMRI machine where they looked at how people's brains were reacting when they tasted Pepsi or tasted Coke. And first they repeated the original Pepsi challenge, which is a blind taste test. And indeed, Pepsi, which is a little bit sweeter up front than Coke is, produced a more positive reaction. People said they preferred the taste, more than half of the people said that. So there was a preference for Pepsi. Then they repeated the exact same test with the brands attached. They said, okay, well, this is Coke you're going to taste, this is Pepsi you're going to taste. And then people preferred Coke, they didn't just say they preferred Coke because they knew it, but they could actually see in the fMRI their brains lighting up a little bit more when they knew they were drinking Coke. And then the last part of the experiment was really kind of diabolical. They switched brands. They told people they were drinking Coke and gave them Pepsi and vice versa. And amazingly, both by self-reporting and by the brain scans, people again preferred Coke, even though it was actually Pepsi. And so that's the power of a strong emotional brand. People have just a different emotional reaction to Coke. That association with the brand is more important than what they're actually tasting.
Well, Roger, there are several more examples of both counterintuitive and what seems to be intuitive advice in your book, Brainfluence, 100 Ways to Persuade and Convince Consumers with Neuromarketing. Tell our listeners, if you would, where they can find out more about Roger Dooley and what you do.
there are a few places. The easiest starting point is rogerdooley.com, R-O-G-E-R-D-O-O-L-E-Y. My blog is called Neuromarketing, and it's located at neurosciencemarketing.com. And then finally, my Forbes blog, which is probably easiest to just search for Roger Dooley Forbes on Google.
And I will post a complete set of links and other information about Roger in the show notes of the podcast. Hey, Roger, thanks for joining us today on The Big Show.
Well, thank you, Jay. It's been a lot of fun.
All the show notes will be posted on the podcast website, powertothesmallbusiness.com, including links to Roger's blogs and his book, Brainfluence. It's where you can also subscribe to this podcast in iTunes or by email. Need some help with your marketing? I offer a free 30-minute coaching and analysis session to a limited number of businesses each month. If you would like one, just go to themarketingspot.com/free coaching, fill out the form, and we'll see if we can schedule you in the next couple of weeks. That's themarketingspot.com/free coaching. I'm Jay Arrett, Dean of Marketing Know-How at themarketingspot.com. We'll catch you on the next episode of Power to the Small Business.
You've been listening to Power to the Small Business with Jay Arrett, the internet show exclusively about small business marketing. Please see the complete show notes at themarketingspot.com. You can also listen to the show online and subscribe in iTunes at powertothesmallbusiness.com. Never miss an episode of the internet show all about small business marketing. Power to the small business.
Our thanks to Mary Lynn Foster of The Big Success Show for the opening and closing credits of the podcast. You can find Mary Lynn at The Big Success Podcast, BIGGSuccess.com.